Sex, the final frontier. These are the voyages of the speculative interdimensional vehicle, Sex in Space. Its mission, to explore new points of view, to seek out fresh opinions, to boldly go where so many have gone before, and still somehow manage to totally miss the point. Subscribe to Sex in Space, wherever quality podcasts are found.
Hi there, and welcome back to Sex in Space. My name's Toshi, and we're excited to have you with us today for another podcast episode. Thanks so much for being here, wherever you're tuning in from. Please make sure to leave a like, comment, or review. Your feedback means the world to us. You can find more great Sex in Space content over on YouTube, including video versions of our podcast episodes if you prefer to watch and listen at the same time. Just search for us using our handle at sexinspace.com. We're also on Instagram and TikTok under that handle too. Today's episode is the second installment in our series with Intersex Aotearoa. I was lucky enough to speak with Dr. Regina Sterling, who is Deputy Chair at Intersex Aotearoa and a lecturer and researcher at the University of Waikato. Regina has a passion for human rights, which was a key focus of their PhD, and was the first openly intersex person in New Zealand to receive a PhD. Last year, Regina published a chapter titled Janet and John, Intersex Invisibility in the New Zealand Curriculum, and that looks at the way that intersex has been excluded from the Western education system and explores ways that intersex can be better represented and included in our curriculum. The focus of today's episode is more broadly the history of intersex, how the story of intersex has changed over time, what we can learn from the past, and why it's so important to educate about what it means to be intersex. Let's get into it. This is going to be our second installment in our three-part podcast series with Intersex Aotearoa, and today we're looking at the history of intersex. We are joined by Regina Sterling, so thank you so much for being here.
No problem.
So I thought I would start by asking, for anyone listening who perhaps hasn't had a chance to listen to the first installment in this podcast series, if you could explain what it means to be intersex.
So to be intersex is a person whose sex traits are genodiverse and or phenodiverse. So that means they're genetics or their phenotype, their expression in bodily type, gonads, genitals, etc., are not clearly definable as male or female. They're outside of that space. Yeah. So, in short, someone who does not fit the male-female binary from a sex trait perspective. So that's why today often people talk about people with variations of sex characteristics.
So I would like to start by asking you how the story of intersex has evolved, where the different roots are from and where you can trace it back to, and how that story and those stories have changed over time.
We'll start with maybe the present, because phrases like variation of sex characteristics is very much of a present day story narrative of how we understand ourselves. And it's very much come from what we'd call the liberal countries, such as the US, UK, New Zealand, who have been kind of at the forefront of such kind of languaging. To go back, so this part will kind of come back to the 1950s with Dr. John Money. And so at that point in time, we were referred to as hermaphrodites, and there's some issues today with some of the community about whether that's a bad word, a slur, etc. But at that time, they were referred to as hermaphrodites, and John Money was looking at ways to classify intersex people within the binary of male or female. And around this time, but not just this time, but also last 50 years or so ahead of it, there was growing acknowledgement of various chromosomes, hormones, and the diversity that of that the body that started to go beyond what people recognized as the reproductive basics of male and female. So biology was getting a bit confusing in far as classification. It was still quite clear, like, this is how males reproduce, females reproduce, and that was used for standard classification. But there was this big blurring in the middle, and that was becoming a big problem for classifying babies. And so Dr. John Money came up with this process of establishing a term called gender, which was a word to use to classify someone's social role and social orientation. So this is how they would act in society, how they would interact with relationships. We often now use the term sexual orientation. And so this term gender came into being. And for John Money, it was not that he totally excluded biological elements, but this was now the primary notion to use for classifications, and then see how it best suited with the other biological elements of that particular person. And so this became a huge change in the medical basis of how intersex people were considered. Prior to that, it was all based on how can we fix based on what we know biologically. That was not focused too much on the social or the sexual orientation part. So that was huge in our recent history. But that got even more divided when Dr. Robert Stoller came in 5-10 years later, and he extended John Money's paradigm, and he took out another phrase called gender identity, which was on top of gender. So you still had gender, but gender identity referred that inner or psychological sense of who I am. And so he took that and took that outside of gender. So you had gender and you had gender identity. So this framing was then applied to transsexuals, now transgender people, because that was his area of focus, whereas for John Money, his primary focus was around hermaphrodite or intersex children. So we'd had both these doctors starting to work in these areas. And this framing was quite massive, because it was that turning point from where the use of hermaphrodite, though still in vogue at that time, doctors were starting to think of ways to work through these and started using terms like pseudo-hermaphrodite for those who they considered were not true hermaphrodites, and that they considered were ones that they could easily deal with and assign easily without major change. And that way they felt like they were doing a much more of a humane practice to bring intersex people into the main fold of what it means to be male and female. And so there was a big change there. And in 2005, I'm just quickly checking my head. I'm pretty sure it was 2005. The Medical Association, I think it was AAP, but I will, that can be fact checked, started to do a consensus statement. And that's where they started to change and call it disorder of sex development. So again, we had this huge shift because they began to acknowledge that for some intersex people, they didn't like the term hermaphrodite, though some were still identifying with that term. And so doctors thought if we call it disorder of sex development, it won't sound so horrific and so much monstrous as it has been in the past, which we'll come back to the past soon. So that was another major shift in languaging. For many in the community, if I use that term quite loosely, being called a disorder was not very likable by many. And so some people started to use the word differences of sex development. But over time, people started then using the term variation of sex characteristics as another way to explain what it means to be intersex without that really heavy pathological definition. And so that's kind of where this term has come in. But that came in kind of in the just after 2012, roughly, somewhere around there.
Recent.
But terms like hermaphrodite actually date back over 2,000 years and kind of come back to like Hermaphrodites as the god. And we've got other phrases used around the world. And I've been kind of searching, even Scotland. I found a few terms that date back at least to 1500. So we've got these other terms. Hermaphrodite is the most well-known. And it's interesting, even with hermaphrodite, people, science has used that term for a while, which is kind of referred to like a self-reproducing organism. But actually, that's still very recent. It's not like it goes back ancient times. It's still roughly early 1800s when that usage came into being. So many today are thinking of hermaphrodite as a slur, but there are some intersex people who are attempting to reclaim some of that because of its connections and spiritual and cultural connections as well, and for some other reasons as well. So there's an interesting mix there from a language perspective. And that's what makes working in the community quite complex, would be a good way today, because people see themselves mainly because the social and the medical effects on the community, that's how people have grown up to understand themselves. So it makes it really complex into how to bring people together and have a common language. But yeah, we can talk more later about the past history and things. But yeah.
It's very interesting, humans need to classify and put things into boxes, and language is very, very reflective of that, I think. And in terms of pioneers in the intersex world, who are some people that you view as pioneers?
Three that come to direct mind for me would be ones like Hedda Valoria, Tiger DeVore, Marnie Mitchell. Marnie, of course, is from Aotearoa, so someone local. The other two are from the US. There are some people that I look up to that were key leaders who were out and open at the time I was understanding who I was. And, yeah, no, they've given me great inspiration.
And in recent times, what is making the subject of intersex something that people are engaging with?
I'm thinking about that. That's something I'm thinking is complex to answer in one way. Because of the languaging that's come up through medicine and has been kind of more adopted through the rainbow community and transgender community in particular, the usage of gender and gender identity, which is starting to cause some conflation that intersex is part of being a gender identity and its connections there. And so people somewhat are starting to engage, but then conflating it with some of these issues and senses of identity, which it's causing some more engagement, but also that conflation of what it means and that medical element, at least from our community's perspective. And so I'm struggling to know whether that's a positive or negative engagement. So I guess in one sense, at least it's engagement, but yeah.
People who are engaging, maybe they're starting to learn and have some conversations. Is there somewhere that you might, a direction or like a resource you would point them at and say, you know, maybe this is a good place to go so that you can have a read and really learn? the facts, I guess.
Yeah. So we do have some information on our website, and I think we've still got some brochures around, which we're in the process of reorganising at Intersex Aotearoa. But yeah, no, it's something that's quite interesting. But I find, at least around me, so in my personal case, if I say intersex and people don't understand, often I just say, for example, hermaphrodite, and people go, ah, I get it. So I think there's still quite a few people who kind of get it, and even if it needs some fine tuning after that to give some clarification, just that little example brings people onto the same page, and then reflect it from there.
Mm. Like an entry point.
Yep. Yeah.
Okay. And in terms of education around intersex and intersex history, is there anyone you think that is doing that well?
Most of the kind of history is really focused around the modern history. So it's kind of around John Money's time and somewhat later. So even that is limited. So not too many are talking about that. And in fact, there are a few books like the Biopolitics of Gender by Jemima Repo, some like that, that have explained the history of gender and its thing quite well and put into context. But yeah, no, there's a lot of history that kind of dates back that is kind of missing, or we've only got fragments. Now that part is, I'm trying to look at somewhat, and there are a few others that are slowly trying to dig back into those areas as well. And I know two who you're going to have a podcast with later is looking into some from the perspective here. So I think there's still a lot more to do. And as I mentioned before, I'm starting to look back and from some of my genealogical past, which kind of goes back to kind of the Scotland and Ireland. So look back at the history there. And again, there's only little fragments, but there's some historical nuggets that I'm starting to find there too.
Like a big jigsaw, and you kind of just get a little piece at a time to
it is.
Get the bigger picture.
Yeah.
Mm. What are some of the positive histories within intersex history?
Ooh, that's another complex one, because a lot of our history, whether it be recent, where they've considered humane, or the past from a Western perspective, has unfortunately not been so positive. So, I guess if we look back at the past first, if we go back from where Greek-Roman society and come forward, at that early stage, being intersex was something people recognised. For example, Aristotle talked about people with hyperspadias. He noticed that they had both a masculine and a feminine quality or personality to them. So they noticed that. But at the same time, any children that were born were either put in baskets to float out to sea and die, or they were sacrificed because they were considered bad omens. So the that part of early history was not so favourable. At different periods of time, they were integrated into society, but again, they had to choose being male or female, and they had to retain that classification. And if they varied from that, that often was more than frowned upon, and sometimes led to severe punishments. So that kind of stage went through probably, well, more than 1,000 years of that kind of life, where you were forced assimilation and severe punishment if you deviated from what you chose as your position. Whereas today, basically it's about enforced medicalization of both body and mind. And that comes back to what we're talking about before with Dr. John Money, Robert Stoller, and the type of society. So yeah, no, it's been a bit of a rough history, to say the least.
Lots and lots of challenges, and there are so many challenges that have happened throughout this history. Are there any that you would point to and say this is important that people know about?
Well, I think history is one of those things. We like to find the good parts of history and kind of focus on that. And if there were some good times, I'm struggling to, in my study so far, to find too many of those good times. But I think we have to recognize that sometimes we have to understand the past, even if it be bad, to move to a better time. And medicalizing somebody, even if it sounds for the good, is sometimes not much better than some of the horrific ways they used to do it in the past. It's just doing it in a different way. Maybe you're not killing somebody, but you're forcing them into this invisible existence that they may or may not associate with. And so, yeah, I think it's somewhat recognizing that. But I think the other thing is to recognize that for some cultures and some indigenous peoples, there was much more acceptance. And so I think we can actually look to that. And I know in some indigenous cultures actually are re-understanding some of those histories that they used to have and how that plays into the present, having to overcome some of the colonized narratives that have been put into societies of more recent times. So there are some kind of, outside of the Western framing, there are some more positive stories, but again, I have less knowledge of those areas, so can't speak too much there.
In terms of intersex history being taught in schools, how would you personally like to see that be done?
So as far from the historical and the school representation, it's really important that children, intersex children, recognize that they're actually part of society. So I've written a chapter in a book recently, and I titled it Janet and John, The Invisibility of Intersex in the New Zealand Curriculum. Because when I grew up, when I was like 5 years old, 6 years old, somewhere there, the books that I remember, which is interesting, I still remember them for some reason, but they were called Janet and John, and there was this boy and there was this girl, and that's all that was represented. So even though I knew there was something I could not understand, because the only representations of society I had was this boy and this girl. And so understanding that intersex people, and knowing that not all, or like some understand themselves within the male space or in the female space and some outside of that, but knowing that there's an older history, knowing that there's a whakapapa or a genealogy that goes back, there are some deities that represent us as intersex people, I think is important. Sometimes in the past, education's just represented it as, oh, there's this kind of mythology, but it's just come some kind of ancient story, but it's not real. And it kind of makes that disconnection from reality and kind of deculturalizes what it means to be human in a sense as well. So it'd be nice. I'm not saying every book has to contain it, but nice for people to kind of see representations here and there, which helps people realize that actually it's okay to be intersex, and it's not an abnormal thing. It's not a disorder. It's not a pathology. Actually, it's part of everyday biology, part of human nature, and that it should always be there. Yeah.
And I think too, you know, for example, for other kids, you know, if they're going to the library and they're picking up a book, even if they're not intersex, being able to read it and recognize it and recognize that like you say, it's normal, and that that, you know, they're reading a book, and this is just part of the world, and this is how people are. And so, you know, it can help people who are intersex recognize and have this kind of visibility for themselves, but also for people around them to be aware as well, I think is really, really great and really important.
Yeah. And for many of these representations, especially at the young age, they don't have to be sexualized or in anything like that. It just needs to be a normal representation, but understanding that the world is more complex than this binary system of just male and female. And and I think that could be done quite well, and enabling that would enable a without offending more conservative parts of society too much, which would then embrace that inclusivity quite well.
What is the name of the book that you wrote your chapter in?
It's Sexuality Education Around the World.
Okay.
Past, present, and future. It's coming out soon. So.
Wonderful. All right. So to all our listeners out there, keep an eye out. I think it would be a great, something great to read, and then maybe take away some information and have a conversation with other people, you know. Is there anything that I haven't asked that you would really like to discuss in terms of the history of intersex?
I think the biggest thing as far as history is understanding the impact that Western socialization of male and female in these binaries based around reproduction, which is very much a Western idea and thought. That does not mean that reproduction is not important to talk about and understand for complex purposes, but to focus on that as the only way to understand society is actually harming many communities, including intersex people, transgender people, etc. And so to understand that, yes, there are some people who can reproduce sexually, including some within those communities. Not all can, but it does not mean that those people who don't are not human. And so to it's important to put the complexity of biology, social life, cultural life, and bring them together. And that's the way to bring a more inclusive society and understand how we see ourselves. Because the last thing I would like to see is a repetition of the past 2,000 years, effectively, just reproduced again to the future. And we've seen that through this World War II with some of the concentration camps. Maybe many of them were Jews, but there were a lot of homosexuals and intersex and transgender people that were caught up in that whole situation as well. And I've even heard of situations where people are encouraged to either abort, or when it comes to IVF, certain embryos were not selected because they had intersex traits. And so we have these selections even today where effectively the same kind of discrimination is occurring.
Goodness.
So I think we've still got a lot to learn from the past to create a much more inclusive and embracing future.
I think that the word complexity is really great, because there is so much space in between for these complexities. And that's how the world is. That's how biology, you know, society, culture, it's complex.
Yeah, it is very complex. And I think the intersex community in its broad term represents so much of that complexity. There's over 40 variations of that have many combinations of different chromosomal, hormone, reproductive anatomy that's all different, different ways the intersex community understand themselves, with a more male basis, more female basis, or somewhat in between, I guess. That's not the right word. But the thing, that's the other problem. We just don't have wording at the moment because of of where we are. So that word complexity, I think, fits very nicely in our whole discussion.
It's a great point about language. I think we need to really expand. It's like how some languages have a word for something and you can't translate it because it doesn't. We don't have a word for it in English.
Yeah.
We need to create words to be able to speak about these things that previously have been ignored.
Mm.
Yeah,
and sometimes it may be creative ways of creating new expressions. So given the fact that, for example, hermaphrodite has been used in somewhat negative ways and some people see it as a slur, maybe it's going to be a creative word that gets formed to reinterpret what it means. So, yeah, no, I still look to an exciting future, even though we've had a bit of a rough past. But when I talk to people around me, I still feel like when they learn and understand, they're relatively accepting. So I think there is hope. There's always hope for the future.
Conversations are so important too, and that's how you learn and it's how you understand different people's perspectives and how your mind can be opened to perhaps perspectives and truths that you people maybe might not have been aware of before.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Wonderful. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to join me and join Sex and Space on the podcast. It's been really lovely to speak with you and to have your insight to all of these questions. I hope anyone out there listening has taken away something from this conversation, maybe about complexity, about language, and they feel more equipped to go out and have a conversation with somebody else and see some fresh perspectives. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. We really hope you enjoyed today's episode. If you want to find out more about what it means to be intersex, head over to intersexrz.org. Before we sign off, we want to remind you to check out our books, How to Talk with Your Kids About Porn and The Organ Education Forgot, which are both available as a downloadable PDF or in print. Just head on over to sexandspace.com to grab your copy. Until next time, safe travels and see you on the next episode.